You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome back to All Things Turd Chats. As ever, it's so nice to have you here. And I hope that if you're not new here, that these conversations I'm having with all my guests about turds and how they've treated them has given you some reassurance that no one swerves tricky life situations. I want to believe that you've allowed space for hope from these chats, hope that there will be a glittery lesson from it all. It might be so hard to see that right now. Trust me, I know that feeling so well. But it will be there. Anyway, I felt I needed to say that because it's apparent to me that a lot of people are going through all manner of turdy experiences right now. This time of year can be particularly hard for some people, so I hope this chat is comforting. My life with cancer feels particularly tricky right now, so if this podcast isn't helping you, it really bloody is helping me. So there's that. Today's chat is a really special one with my long-term pal Fern Cotton. We had so much to talk about that Neil has had to actually create two parts to this chat. In the same way, I didn't really feel I could or should introduce Fern. I don't really feel I need to introduce this chat. But suffice to say that we cover a lot of ground around her mental health and her inner critic and the perils of the media and then eventually finding her happy place. My cat Lady Marmalade felt the need to join our recording session too, and when she's not begging me for food, you might hear her walking around on my laminate floor. I actually think she sounds a bit like an angry typist, sort of ferociously typing away an old typewriter in the corner. That's the picture I've got in my head right now, actually. It's a really good job Fern is as obsessed with cats as I am, really. Anyway, shall we get on and play the recording? Okay, let's. Usually I introduce my guests and I just don't think I really feel like I need to do that with you. So I thought about things that people might not know about you. The fact that you really detest green tea.
Correct.
That you're, I mean, I don't know, this might be a bit more obvious for people that know you quite well, an introverted cat obsessive. You're really good at buying presents for people. Like, you're exceptional and you're so punctual with shit like that as well. You're so organized.
Yes, I'm a Virgo, correct. Yeah.
You love Dave Grohl more than life and you will be in bed by 9.
Yes, if not 8:30.
Even better. Best of all, she's my mate. And ever since she willingly ran a half marathon for Copperfield in 2011, and you haven't looked back, have you?
I haven't. Well, really, from the first moment I met you, because I met you at an awards thing, for a fancy awards ceremony many moons ago, and you obviously stuck a sticker on me and then did a runner. And we've just been mates ever since, and we've had lots of sort of serendipity with me going on a walk with someone that you already knew, lovely Jenny, who was waxing lyrical about you. And it was, it was meant to be.
It really was. And now it's like 11 years later. Wow. So I think we should get into it. Like, tell me what your turd is, please.
Okay, my turd is sort of a broad spectrum of things, but it comes under the banner of poor mental health. And that's not forever and it's not always, but certainly I've had periods of poor mental health and still I'm very much tripped up by sometimes the hangover of that period, but also just sort of other mental health scenarios that I've sort of encountered and still do. So that's very much been a sort of part of my life. I was going to actually say from the age of 30, but really when I look back, because I had eating disorders in my 20s, it really started at 19, I think, because the more I learn about eating disorders, that very much fits under the heading of mental health issue, which I sort of had pushed to one side for a bit. So I think that's been kind of my nemesis, but also my gift in many ways as well.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's something that you feel like you can live alongside, right? Because you've had this for such a long time. You're constantly navigating life with it. But when you reckon it started around 19, but obviously you stepped into like a situation where you were in the limelight, you were being judged by a lot of people since you were 15. And do you think that is where you started to look at yourself in a way that was not healthy?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, probably in a very, very subtle way at first, because I was a kid and I had been, in my eyes, sort of plucked from obscurity. I was just living a regular life in the suburbs, like very just normal stuff I was doing, going to school, hanging out in the park with my mates. And then all of a sudden I was sort of a part of this world that I was so transfixed by. You know, I was obsessed with watching TV like most sort of teenagers in the 90s and listening to pop music, and that whole world looked so magical to me. And it really felt it for quite a while, I think from 15, probably until about 19, because I was sort of on kids' TV there then, which was a much gentler environment and a lot more protected. And I was working with a team of producers that were so wonderful. I mean, they're, you know, Maddie, who was my first ever TV producer, is still in my life today and someone that I will always be so grateful for taking a chance on this sort of random 15-year-old. And we were really nurtured and looked after. But I think there were probably incremental moments during that time of probably like not processing what was going on around me, but just sort of in fight or flight dealing with it. And I didn't feel any anxiety at that period of my life. I didn't struggle at all. I was just sort of going through it. But I was obviously exposed to this sort of weird critique, judgment that again was much more diluted back then because we didn't have social media. So it was really only like tidbits of information that you would get. You wouldn't get full on written commentary. It was just sort of sometimes passing comments from people that you knew, which, you know, didn't really affect me too badly. But I was certainly then aware of that. And that kind of, you almost view yourself as a spectator as well. It's really strange. Mm-hmm. And I still do that today. I sort of can see myself from an outside point of view in a warped way. But I think also, you know, I was, as a young teenager, I was also meeting all of these sort of little pop stars who looked all perfect and shiny, and they had stylists and makeup artists and a whole team of people around them. And, you know, and back in the day when I was on the telly at that age, I'd literally rock up, I'd wear some awful clothes I'd bought from Wembley Market, and you'd do the show and then go back home to your mum's house. You know, it wasn't fancy, it wasn't glamorous. So that was always quite jarring for me. And that's where I think I started to feel like a bit detached from everything. Like, wow, they're shiny and perfect and amazing, and I'm this sort of average kid who's just ended up in this weird job. And I started to see myself as something very separate to the world I was in. And again, it didn't cause me any anxiety or any trauma. But I think at 19, when I then started doing sort of Saturday Kids TV, which is a bit older, a bit more exposed, and also Top of the Pops, that's where I think I started to struggle a bit and feel wildly out of control, actually.
Yeah, because I think you talk a lot about this inner critic, because, yeah, like you just mentioned, social media might not have been around at that time. So instead, you had this like inner voice telling you that you weren't meant to be there and you weren't good enough to be there. I mean, actually, your inner critic, like from what I've read and what I've, you know, heard you say, your inner critic sounds like a bit of a knob.
My inner critic is so loud and noisy. Yes. And I, you know, at 41, I'm much more aware of it, but I don't feel like I'm any better at mitigating it, if I'm honest. But I have an awareness, so I can distinguish, okay, this is just that tape that I'm really used to hearing. This isn't the truth. Because, I, you know, I'll beat myself up today about, you know, more everyday stuff like, I couldn't do the school run that day, or just silly things to do with the kids that I worry about. Am I being a good enough parent? Am I doing the best that I could do? Or am I doing well at work? Am I putting as much effort in as I could? I could be better. And it's just those two points in my life, there is a sort of constant commentary going on in my head. But I think the work one's been exacerbated by social media and the press, really. That that's where things got super dark for me, was when that element came in. And it is a nasty, nasty world. And it still is now. It's not any better. It hasn't got any kinder. It's grim. And it is absolutely confidence shredding. Yeah. And it's just ignites the flame of self-loathing quicker than anything. It's mad. So I think that's where it really started to get ugly, was the whole, oh, right, there's like grown-ass adults who have a paid job sat at a computer typing out how much they don't like me, or whatever the commentary might have been. Yeah. And that, I still don't deal well with that. Whereas I can probably, with social media, find some logic behind, you know, not reading into it. I think with the press, it just still feels like so out of control and hideous.
So vicious. Do you look at some headlines sometimes, or do you hear, or do you see how other people are now in the firing line, and kind of like, what do you think about them, and how do you almost like want to shield them? Like how do you protect that? How do you protect yourself from it?
I don't think you can, and that's the terrifying thing about it, is that when a journalist, and it could be a single journalist, makes up a headline or an angle of a story and it's out there, you're totally out of control, because everyone else's reaction is, you know, going to be bespoke to them depending on how they're feeling that day, and if they want to use you as a bit of a target because it's easy and they can dehumanize you. And but then the story's out there, and then, you know, careers are ruined by that. And, you know, the newspapers have done that to so many people, and worse, as we know, and worse. Yeah. And it still hasn't got better. And I still don't understand how the people that write these articles can do it and feel okay about themselves. Like, you know, we've all said things that we regret, and we've all bitched about people and said silly things. We've all got sort of regret around that, I'm sure, if we were all really honest with ourselves. I certainly have. Hands up. There's loads of things I wish I hadn't said and done. But when you're paid to do it and you're doing it regularly, and you know what the fallout can be, because we've seen people very publicly completely fall apart and, let's cut to the chase, die. Mm-hmm. How can they still keep doing it? I will never, ever understand it. And it certainly in my early 30s and late 20s, actually, contributed to an all very, very vulnerable state of poor mental health. You know, it absolutely affected me in the worst possible way. Yeah. And I still don't know how to react to it rationally, you know, because I could sit there with sensible friend like you who might say, look, just don't listen to it. It doesn't matter, whatever. But I feel like I don't have the tools in place to go, oh yeah, you're right. Like, this will blow over. It's a physical reaction to, even if I see my PR guy's number come up on my phone, I'm already properly having an anxiety attack. I won't pick up the phone. I'm like, can you just text me if this is awful or if it's just a question? So I have a really disproportionately over the top reaction to any of that. But it's horrible. It's a horrible, horrible world.
But is it that disproportionate? Because for me, I would feel exactly the same. And I have no doubt that so many people in the same position as you have that reaction too, because you're human and we all make mistakes. We all do these things. And the fact that you bear the brunt because you happen to be more in the limelight than fucking me going to the shops every day.
I mean,
you know, just like,
you're
it's
right. I think, you know, maybe it's not disproportionate. I don't know. I think sometimes I have said to myself, probably because I have quite a harsh inner critic, like, oh God, you know, people are going through far worse, just sort of crack on with it. But when I can look at the lows that I've been in and the place that it's taken me to, and I mean, you know, at the start of my 20s, I literally had no confidence, like none, to the point where I started to, you know, not do a lot of the, and I still don't do a lot of the jobs that I used to do because I don't, I mean, part of it is because I just don't feel pulled towards that work anymore. Yeah. It doesn't excite me like it used to. But there is a large element that is, I don't want to be exposed in that way and out there in that way for everybody to grab a part of me and make up their mind about who I am or what I stand for. I can't stomach it. And I'm not built for it at all. I don't know if many people are. I think I know a few people who sort of are, and they can deal with it, and they can kind of go, oh, I don't care, this is part of the job. I am not built for it. I am sensitive and take things very personally and already have this acerbic voice in my head. I don't need that to be pumped up by other voices, quite frankly. So yeah, I don't deal well with it at all.
But I think that's, you know, good that you can acknowledge that and you can kind of go, well, take action, step away from it. Like, a lot of people might struggle on forever and ever more because they feel like that's it for them. That's the only thing that'll give them that boost that they need, but also hate it.
Yeah. But you've got to look at your own ego, which I still have to do every day, because I could easily watch someone on a TV show or, you know, doing something cool and think, oh, well, I'm failing. I'm not doing very well. Am I? I'm not doing that. I wasn't asked to do that. And then I have to go, okay, if you were offered that job, would you want to do it? And a part of my ego goes, yeah, I want to be asked. And the other bit goes, God, I really wouldn't actually want to do the job bit and have the exposure bit. And I have to constantly check myself with that. And, you know, I am still putting myself out there to an extent. It feels much more comfortable because I've created my own little world out of necessity where I can still use the skill set that I've acquired over the last 25 years. I can still do the creative bit that really floats my boat, but I'm not out there to the point where I'm being followed by paparazzi. I mean, my life is far too boring to be followed by paps. Like, back in the day, I couldn't leave the house without there being a man following me. Like, I could be in the middle of a park on a run and someone would jump out a bush. It was horrific. Now, what are they going to catch? Me, like, putting the bins out? Luckily, I'm so boring that there is nothing to follow or document, and I am so grateful for that.
Yeah, but that takes guts also to kind of say, oh, I need that ego boost, but actually, nah, this is way better for me. I need to step away from this. Like, I think it's brave, really brave.
Well, I guess it was sort of, I had to look at, like, is this making me happy? And if I really, like, sat and wrote a list, the stuff that makes me feel really good is writing, brings me more joy than anything. And I'm working on two writing projects at the moment, and I couldn't be happier than when I'm with my laptop on my own writing. I couldn't be happier. And interviewing people, which I luckily get to do in this format. And then there's other bits and bobs that, you know, you do to kind of keep everything gelled together and working that maybe is less driven by sort of passion, but you know it's worth putting the work in because it brings all the projects together and helps sort of cement them. But if I look at all the sort of stuff where you would get a tantalizing, you know, 10 minutes of everyone saying you're amazing or you look amazing or I saw you on that show, I know that's going to last for that 10 minutes and then it's gone. Like it's not everlasting. So then you have to do it again. And I just think, oh, I just can't put myself through that anymore. I just really can't. And, you know, and then every now and again, your ego gets bashed because, like, I remember once I was doing this TV thing probably only a couple of years ago, and it was a very, you know, rare sort of TV appearance for me. And the lighting guy was someone I'd worked with for years, lovely bloke. And he went to me, God, I haven't seen you for years. Do you still work these days? And I was like, oh my God, I work harder than I've ever worked. But I just thought, I'm not even, like, he doesn't know. So I was like, yeah, bits and bobs. And, like, obviously my ego is like, fuck you, I'm working, like, double what I used to work doing all these projects and the stuff that I do behind the scenes. But I thought, I just don't need to get into it. I was like, yeah, it's all good. So, you know, again, a little moment to just ground and go, okay, that for 1 second felt sort of weirdly painful. But why? Yeah. Oh, because my ego needs to be, like, seen and heard. Uh-huh. And actually it doesn't matter. So, you know, it's not like, yeah, I've cracked it. I don't need outside validation. Like, I think we all seek it on varying levels. I'm just probably a little bit more self-aware these days as to why I'm doing it. Yeah. Am I just feeling a bit shit that day?
Yeah.
Do I feel insecure? Is posting something or being on a TV show actually going to fix a problem? No.
Yeah.
Of course it's not.
And it's just almost kind of sad and a good reality check to kind of go, this person lives in such a warped world where what work seem like the only work that it seems valid in his eyes is telework or being seen out in the world in that space. So the fact that you are almost enlightened and know that there's more to life than that is not great now, isn't it?
Oh yeah, without a doubt, there's so much more. Like, I really put it into practice. Like, say if I see on Instagram you know, people out at a big show busy red carpety type thing and they're looking amazing, great dress, yada yada, there is, I think, like, for most people, a bit that goes, oh fuck, I didn't get invited to that, and I look disgusting right now, I've got a gross tracksuit on, I've got all like fucking hummus down my trousers or whatever it is, and you start to feel a bit shit about yourself. And in those moments I go, right, if someone said to me now, right, put this dress on, do your makeup, get in this car and go to that event, would you want to go? No, I'm sat with my kids on the sofa watching, we just watched that amazing new film Slumberland. I couldn't be happier in my dirty top. What? And I'm not just sort of saying this to, like, sound all virtuous. I would rather do that than anything. I don't actually want to be at that show busy thing, but it sort of looks all shiny and great on Instagram. And then you go, actually, I don't want to be there. I really don't.
Can we go back to, like, okay, so your mental health and being aware that, you know, you have depression and you suffer with things like insomnia and panic attacks. You are also now aware that you're not very good at asking for help. So how does that work then?
Well, that is very much work in progress. You know, I haven't had a massive period of depression for years and years. You know, initially there was a big block that took me a long time to come out of because there were circumstances in my life that were very tricky to navigate and a lot of outside noise and a lot of abuse from the press, absolute abuse that I don't know why I put up with it actually at the time. I was just very not in a good headspace, but people being vile about me actually, and I felt so awful, and it took me a long time to come out of that. I don't know what the timeline would be because it's very difficult to notice the moments where you go, oh yeah, that might have been the end of that period. I just don't know. But I still deal with anxiety and and anxiety slash panic attacks. Less so, actually, recently. But my nemesis still is sleep anxiety. That, for me, I don't know how to combat it. I actually spoke to Giovanna about this about 2 days ago because we were talking about the big Copperfield trek that they've just been on, and I was quizzing her about it on the phone and sounded amazing. And she was like, oh, I really want you to come on one. And I was thinking, what is it that is stopping me? And I was very honest with her. I said, look, this sleep anxiety thing for me is quite debilitating, because if I get into the really nitty gritty, and you know me, I'm very honest, I've got nothing to hide. Mm. My sleep anxiety manifests like this. If I'm not in my bed at home where everything is exactly the same as I'm used to, with my same eye mask, my earplugs, my pillows, like the whole thing, I'm in my home. If I'm staying somewhere else, or God forbid I had to share a bed or a room with someone, I cannot mentally cope with that at this point in my life. So that leads to this weird, I don't know if it's like it's like a weird compulsion that I have to keep going to the loo, and I don't even need the loo. But on a bad day, like I stayed in a hotel recently and that cycle went on every few minutes for 2 hours. I was like, I can't do this anymore. I just like a gym workout. I'm like, go to the toilet, come back to bed a minute later. Nope, gonna have to go again. And I feel like I can't control that compulsion to go. It's really odd. And I haven't cracked that one in therapy or with any of the tools that I have. That one for me is still a biggie. And so I said to G, unless I crack this, I don't know how I could be in a tent, because I would be, the person in the tent with me would be literally going mental, because I don't see how I would feel. It's something about safety. I don't know, like if I'd feel safe to be able to shut off from the world and go to sleep. It's really odd. So that I'm still, you know, and Jessie's away at the moment and that always throws me. Yeah. So I've slept so poorly for the last week because I've just got that compulsion or tick or whatever it is. And I just can't get myself to sleep. Or if the kids wake up in the night, which is all the time, I then can't get back to sleep because this thing kicks in of, oh, you probably won't go back to sleep now. Yeah. And then the toilet thing comes in and it's like, oh my God. So that one still is, that's the one that I'm dealing with probably more potently presently out of all of the things. I tend to do less work now that causes panic attacks, because it is really, that's quite a work-based thing, panic attacks. Yeah. It's not really so much a life, real life thing. It's a work thing.
Yeah.
I can hear your cat.
Yeah, she's a bell end. Ignore. Oh, God.
I love her. Meow, feed me. She's got a question.
You've literally been fed. Okay, you want to say hi? Or you want to say hi?
No,
okay.
I haven't, she said.
You're working out.
She's so lovely.
Hello.
I've locked Simon the cat out so he can't disturb me, because otherwise he would be in here going mad at me.
Well, I can't. She doesn't go out. I'm gonna try and ignore, and Neil's gonna have to do really well at like getting rid of the sound. what I wanted to say is, like, also, if you are not sleeping on this trek, then you won't be good for walking either. So I do get it.
No.
And I'm not gonna try and convince you. I'll let G do that. But it's interesting. If I didn't know you, the first thing I'd be like, yeah, but there are so many tools, and there are drugs like sleeping pills, and you could try meditation, and you could try, like, you know, what's your sleep hygiene like before you go to bed, and all that shit that we now know about. But I know for a fact you would have tried all these things. So, it must be so frustrating.
Yeah. Sometimes it makes it worse, because sometimes you go, like, say I do, and you know, I do a lot of these things, as you know, like breath work with the wonderful Rebecca Dennis that you've met and worked with, who is game changing, and she's helped me massively. But say I start doing a breathing technique when I'm in that state, after 5 minutes, when it hasn't worked, I start to feel worse. Like, oh, well, even that didn't work, so I'm really fucked now, because I did the breathing thing. And that's how mental I am, that I can't even go to sleep after doing a full on. So I then start to sort of beat myself up, because I think at night things are so much worse, even if you don't have anxiety. You know, it's dark, everyone else is asleep. You imagine that everyone in the country is asleep and you're the only one that's awake, and it's quiet, there's no distractions, and it's like, oh, it's a noisy place up there. And, you know, I love my brain because it can do brilliant creative things. And I'm the sort of person that, luckily, I have ideas all day, work ideas, thoughts, questions. Like, my brain is a really creative place, but it doesn't switch off. So, you know, I do my yoga. I'm on off with the meditation, and that is probably part of the problem, that I you know, it'd be good to do more. But I do really use that breath work in the yoga, and I go on big long meditative walks. I went on one this morning after the school run. But yeah, I think it's just, that is still at this point, and I don't think it's forever, but at this point, having kids and with work being busy and just all the sort of demands of the modern world, sleep is, yeah, it's still the one for me that I really struggle with. Yeah.
Do you think it was got worse or was triggered after you had kids? Because Ma used to be able to sleep, my twin Ma, for anyone that doesn't know, she used to be able to sleep, and ever since having Herbie, she needs, a bit like you, to have everything. Like, she needs to go to bed at a certain time, otherwise she stresses about not having enough sleep. And just like, and yeah, like, yeah, she, but then she overthinks it. And I just think, well, just don't even, just try not to think about it. Just like, just go to bed.
Yeah,
and
I do that.
And because
I do that, yeah, I overthink it.
Yeah. And so it's that overthinking, because then you're thinking about the sleep that you might not get, and that is preventing you from sleeping, even though you haven't even attempted to sleep yet. And it's just like, oh, I can't get my head around it, because I, not to brag or anything, but I'm such a good sleeper. And I feel like
I used to be able to sleep anywhere. Like, I, in my 20s, I spent the whole of my 20s on a transatlantic flight. You know, I was just constantly in the States working and then back here. I didn't deal with jet lag. I was just like sleeping wherever I was, on a plane, on in a chair, wherever. So I think it's hard to determine what the catalyst was, because it's all a bit of a blur, and I never get too focused on the sort of timeline thing. But I sort of had this big period of depression, and it was in and amongst the time when I had Rex. And I genuinely, because I think it's really affected my memory, actually, going through stuff that wasn't very pleasant. I can't remember what happened first. Did I have Rex first? Did this all kick off when I was pregnant? I don't have any desire to go and look back into it, to be honest. But it all kind of happened around the same time. But I was still a good sleeper until the anxiety didn't kick in at all until I was about 35. So for 5 years, I was probably sort of, you know, dealing with some big low moods and very low self-esteem. But anxiety, didn't have it at all. Slept well, absolutely fine. And then really it was kind of, I think, after I had Honey, where out of the blue, it was literally my first panic attack was totally and utterly out of the blue. I was driving on the motorway with my mate Claire, and I just said, I'm feeling really odd. And I genuinely didn't know what the hell was happening. But I went really hot. I opened all the windows, and then I couldn't catch my breath. And then I started, my vision was going out of line. So I couldn't focus on what was in front of me and how far things were away. So I pulled over, totally freaked out. And I just couldn't get my shit together to get back on the motorway. So we called the AA, who very kindly sort of came and rescued us. And from that point on, from that day, for whatever reason, they kicked in on that day. They were absolutely ferocious for months. I was getting them several times a day, every day. And I was covering for this live TV show at the time, and I was in a state of, like, I was, felt like I was leaving my body. And I carried on doing the show. I was like, if it was me today, I'd say, I'm out, I'm not doing it, I'm staying at home today. But I sort of pushed through and did it. And these panic attacks were really potent and regular for months. And now I don't really do those sorts of jobs. So it, and it, but I couldn't drive on the motorway for 5 years. Mm. I started driving on the motorway again last year. And I want to say this for people out there that have this motorway anxiety specifically, because I've met a lot of people over the years that have it. Mm. You can crack it. Mm. Like, I've cracked it. Mm. I still get a little thing where I go, oh, and I go, no. And I have to almost shut off this part of my brain. You have to go, no, I'm not, that part of my brain's not opening today. And then I can do it. And it has been, I feel so proud of myself. I feel so utterly chuffed that I, because this one was debilitating again in the terms of, I couldn't bloody go anywhere. If Jesse was away, I just couldn't go anywhere. But now I'm back on the motorway. I can see my friends that live in Surrey. I can go and visit my parents. It's like, I feel so grateful that I'm back on the motorway. And it is possible. I specifically used EMDR therapy for that. And it was very, very helpful. Very helpful.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
I tried EMDR recently, actually. It is fascinating, isn't it? Have you, the person that I had, who I did it with online, she actually gave me some soundtracks to listen to after that, because I haven't done any more sessions. But it's so fascinating. It makes your eyes, because if anyone doesn't know, it's about, like, basically you're using your eyes to almost distract this part of your brain. And then you have a therapist, an EMDR therapist, who's kind of going, look over here, look over there. And it's just like in a way, you're rewiring something to make your brain not behave in that certain way or have that certain trigger again in the future. And it is fascinating how that works. That's so good. It's so good that it worked for you.
Yeah, it really did. And I should probably revisit it for the sleep thing, because I don't doubt that it would really help that. But I was really kind of focusing on that specific anxiety because it was becoming sort of problematic. And it really helped. And actually, a friend of mine, when he had seen that I'd Instagrammed about having this motorway anxiety, he got in touch and was like, oh my God, I don't really talk about it, but I have that. And he hadn't driven the motorway for like 18 years. And I put him in touch with an EMDR specialist that I know. And he's back driving on the motorway. It's so cool. It's so cool. And wonderful to show that the brain has this neuroplasticity and we can rewire it and retrain it and make it, you know, do what we need it to do. It just obviously requires a lot of work. Sometimes you have to go to painful places to do that work. It's not like fun or easy or like you do it once and it's done. But I do believe that with practice and patience, you can crack these phobias and fears and blocks, really.
I want to focus a bit on the glitter. So obviously, you know, you've had various different mental health issues over the time, and you've tried various things to help you, and some have worked, some haven't, and it's an ongoing journey with figuring things out, but also an ongoing journey with, and I think having read your book and knowing you for so long, it's also working out who you are and why these things certainly get driven in certain directions, and your spirit, and like that ongoing cultivation of your spirituality. Would you say it's like happening alongside your healing?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. You know, some of it out of necessity that I've wanted to try new things and broaden my mind. But actually, the more I sort of walk down that path, the more I just feel right in that space, learning and cultivating some sort of deeper connection with the people in my life and the environment around me and just life itself, I guess, that feels great. And now more often than not informs what I do in my working life as well as my life. You know, it's kind of informing it all. The ideas kind of start in the healing bit of life. You know, that I'm kind of, that's why I guess I feel so lucky with Happy Place. I'm never coming from the point of view with Happy Place like, guys, I've got it all sorted here. I've cracked it. Listen to me and you too can feel amazing every day. Like, I'm very much trying things out, some days feeling wicked, some days struggling. And it's really lovely to do that en masse with other people who I feel like I'm in this giant conversation with, whether it's the podcast or the festivals or the app or any of the other projects we're doing, or just on Instagram, you know, having these chats. And what feels like a real privilege, and I guess part of this, the glittering aspect, is I could be out walking down the street or milling around the Happy Place Festival or wherever I might be, doing a talk somewhere. And due to the change of work that I do now since I started Happy Place, people come up to me and off the bat share their story with me. And at the deepest level, you know, I hear about someone's acute pain or beautiful healing or whatever it might be before we've even said hi. We're straight in. And that feels weird, incredible, an honor. Like, I feel like I'm properly meeting people. And that, I will never, ever get over that or feel flippant about it or blasé about it. It's remarkable. And I did not foresee that happening in my life. I couldn't have imagined a connection like that with strangers. It's remarkable. So that massively drives me forward and definitely cancels out any of the negatives that might still be floating around the edges. You know, who gives a fuck if someone's talking shit about me online or some idiot journalist is saying something cruel? I can walk up to somebody and have an amazing, deep conversation and walk away feeling like I've learned something, like I've properly connected with someone. That makes all of it worth it. Mm-hmm. So that is like the shiniest of glitter.
Yes. And can I just tell everyone that I witnessed that happening at your festival this year, where someone was sharing this information of, I mean, I don't know what the story was. It looked like a really deep and meaningful conversation that you guys were having. And I just wonder, and obviously I text you afterwards, because that it's a lot. It's amazing, but it's a lot to kind of absorb. And because you have said yourself, like, you are like a sponge, you absorb other people's energy so much. And I think it's a gift to have that, to be so intuitive and to really feel things deeply. I think probably for you, sometimes it feels like a curse, but it is also a gift. And I'm sure you recognize that. But it must be also so exhausting for someone who does take things on so much.
Yeah, I think the Happy Place Festival is the perfect example, because we had the London Festival and the Manchester one, and we had 6,000 people at each event. And I was walking around as much as I could, meeting people, wanting to hear what their feedback was on the festival itself so we can make it better, and just to chat to people and basically meet the Happy Place audience, because they're integral to all the projects. If we don't have an audience that are communicating with us, engaged with what we're doing, we don't exist. So I was walking around the whole time chatting to people and having these incredibly deep conversations. And, you know, people were telling me some pretty horrendous stuff that had happened to them personally, you know, awful things. Mm. And we cried together and we hugged. I do feel everything. So I feel deeply moved when someone tells me a story. And it's a stranger. I never met this person, but I feel deeply moved. I think I've always been that way inclined. Even as a kid, I can get very deeply emotional about anything. And it felt absolutely magical and beautiful during those two-day events. And I was still flying high on the Monday after both, But like clockwork, about probably 48 hours after, I felt, it's so hard to describe, sort of floored and sort of flattened and I didn't really know what to do with all of it, I think, is the outcome. I'd been told all these stories. I'd hopefully offered some sort of empathy or at least made that person feel heard and seen, which I think is what a lot of us are looking for. And I really want to give people that experience. But I felt depleted of everything. And I wouldn't swap it for the world. Mm-hmm. I'll do exactly the same next year. But I think I'll expect that that will happen because, you know, the stuff that I was told is just, you just think, God, people are going through so much. There's so many, you know, there's a lot of beauty and light out there, but there's obviously a lot of dark and terrible things happening to people. And it's heartbreaking. And I just felt a bit hopeless. So I don't know what to do. Like, I think then a week later, when I have been able to process moments like that, I go, right, we have more work to do. And what is it? There are people struggling and we've got a platform and we've got the resources and I know the people. What the hell are we going to do about it? And that's where I get the fire in my belly again. But I think I had to go through that period before I was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do with all these stories and all this stuff. And it really, really hit. I was just peak exhaustion, I think. But then, you know, you get your fire in the belly and you get back to work on thinking up ideas, I guess.
See, I told you we cover a lot of ground. So you'll need to make sure you listen to next week's episode for the rest of our chat. But for now, let's remember our need to have a really good laugh, to be silly and joyful with friends. Perhaps also work out what your inner critic is saying and asking how valid any of that is. I absolutely hate that Fern's self-esteem has in the past been shattered by the press for no gain other than to sell more papers. I don't think it's got any better. I mean, right now it feels worse than ever. The press have never been more vile. In a way, I'm so proud of Fern for her resilience, but also to finally uncover and realise what no longer makes her happy and to step away from all of that. In part two of our chat, we dive a little bit deeper into how Fern eventually managed to glitter her turd and the lessons she's learned along the way. There's probably also more interruptions for my cat too, so please don't miss it. So see you then. Bye for now.